Hello and welcome to Baylor Connections, a conversation series with the people shaping our future. Each week we go in-depth with Baylor leaders, professors, and more, discussing important topics in higher education, research, and student life. I'm Derek Smith, and our guest today is Dr. Lori Baker. Dr. Lori Baker serves as Professor of Anthropology and Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity at Baylor. In 2003, she founded Reuniting Families, a program that assists local, state, and federal U.S. agencies, as well as foreign governments, with the recovery, identification, and repatriation of deceased migrants found along the U.S.-Mexico border. Baker, her colleagues, and students have repatriated hundreds of migrants over the last 16 years, assisting local agencies and helping families find closure. Her work has been featured on a variety of outlets, from ABC and NPR to newspapers and magazines across the country, and she's with us today here on the program. Dr. Lori Baker, our guest, thanks so much for joining us. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me here and giving me a chance to talk about something I feel very passionately about and that we've had numerous students through the years contribute to.
Well, I think your passion for this topic will come across, and as we kind of paint that picture of what this looks like, what the work you do looks like, and what it accomplishes over these next 20 minutes or so. Look forward to diving into this, and let's dive right in. So where did you first begin to notice the need for the work you do, that there were people who were unidentified who you needed to figure out who they were and find out who their families were?
You know, I was a sophomore in college, so I was the age of most of the students that I'm around today.
And you're at Baylor.
I was at Baylor, and this really wonderful professor forced me to go out on forensic cases to learn what it meant to be a forensic anthropologist. Little did I know that's what I'd end up being when I grew up. But she took me out on a case, and the case was in South Texas. It wasn't a case of an undocumented immigrant. It was a different case. And the sheriff we were speaking with wanted to know, how does one learn to do what we were doing? And so I was explaining, you look at a lot of skeletons, you look at the little differences between each skeleton, and then you start to understand the nuances of how to identify whether someone's a male or a female, what their ancestry may be, how to tell their stature. But we needed a lot of skeletons to look at to see those differences. And that I was planning to go to graduate school at a place where they had a lot of skeletons. And he said, oh, you don't have a lot of skeletons at Baylor? And I was like, no, we have, you know, a lot of ancient skeletons, but not a lot of moderns. So he goes, oh, well, we can get you as many as you want. And wow. That's not something people typically say. Mm-hmm. And took us aback. And, you know, I probably took a step backwards at that point and said, how can you do that? And he said, well, we have all these people that are coming across the border and dying. Nobody wants them. You could just have them. We'll send them to Baylor and you can have them. Well, wow. It was because sheriffs like that didn't take the time to try to do the identification of these individuals. So we were there working on a U.S. citizen case. But cases of undocumented immigrants just didn't rise to the occasion of being investigated. And part of that, I understand now, diving into this, it's a lack of resources, a lack of understanding, a lack of experts. I mean, there's a lack of everything along the border. But very disturbing to hear that context of somebody saying, you can just have them because no one wants them. And I'm sure I wasn't very politically correct in the way that I responded to him at that particular moment, much like my students would probably be like, well, of course there are people who want them. What's wrong with you? But it was something that stayed on my heart for a very long while. And knowing that this was going on and knowing that it wasn't being addressed and imagining if it wasn't being addressed in that county, it probably wasn't being addressed in other counties across the border. I had the good fortune in graduate school to work with a lot of very good colleagues. And most of my colleagues were doing work around the world, a lot of humanitarian work in identifications of genocides, mass extinction efforts, and mass grave work, you know, Bosnia, Herzegovina, Guatemala. And I started getting all these calls. At the time, I was really working on forensic science research, but not casework. And people needed someone who understood how to do bone DNA, how to talk to families about the evidence that we'd collect, how we'd use that evidence, how we protect them, and so forth. So I was working in Peru with a team of international experts to set up the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. And as we were sitting around one night talking about what each of us were working on, the stories that I was hearing from each person, and these are all folks from places that are not as affluent as the U.S., and they're working in, of course, very places that are very challenged. Mm-hmm. And each person went around saying what they were doing, which were all horrific mass grave type operations. And I was working in the lab doing some research from some 10,000-year-old teeth from a cave. And they got to me, and this is after I heard about a mass grave of children in Guatemala, and we're all in tears. And I'm thinking, how can I talk about what I'm working on when it's so insignificant compared to what the needs of the world are? And I shared with them when they got to me, and everyone said, well, it must be nice to be from the U.S. You don't have any of these atrocities, because most of the people dealing with these atrocities were from the countries that they were working in. And I said, no, we don't, but we have something different. And I explained what was going on the border and that it had disturbed me, and I wanted to do something about it, but I wasn't sure where to start. And it was amazing. Every person sitting around with me said, hey, we'll come. Tell us what we can. Tell us when to come. We'll be there. So I went back, and I was in Tennessee in graduate school at the time, and went back and told my husband, hey, I feel like God's calling me to go to the border to start a program to identify undocumented immigrants and repatriate them to their families. And he looked at me and he goes, okay, how? And, you know, it wasn't a week or two later that I got a call from Baylor. And, you know, it just was amazing that Baylor opened their arms. When I went into my administrative interview, I kind of thought they'd go, yeah, that's really weird, and thank you, and you're a nice person, but that's not what universities do, because it isn't what universities did. And instead, they said, wow, we want faculty that are motivated by their faith, how they are animated to action by that faith, and how they bring students along so they can see your vocation lived out. And I was sold. I was so excited to get to come back to Baylor and to do this work and to bring students to a place where they knew that they can make a difference in the world at that particular moment. They didn't have to wait until later in life like I did to be able to do something with the knowledge and expertise that we have. So would you like me to talk about kind of what the situation
yes,
is
please.
On the border? So we created Reuniting Families because there wasn't the resources that were needed. And we assumed that if we started and created a database, that at least we could make sure that there was no person that was lost completely. What we found is that most of the counties, when they find someone who's deceased and thought to be an undocumented immigrant, their remains are recovered and they're buried in unmarked graves. There's not a lot of documentation in that process. So in that, we found that because there's no documentation, there's no record of these individuals. So there's no way for families to figure out what happened to them because there's no record of them at all in the system, which means they're also not captured in the data that the government captures. So when we talk about border deaths, we're using a number that is generated by the U.S. Border Patrol. And those are the cases that they're involved in, which means these cases in these counties all along, especially the Texas border, don't have much involvement, and they're not counted. So as much as we know that there are a lot of deaths that are happening on the border, there are exponentially more. So it's a vast problem, and unfortunately, it's not getting any better. We're still seeing deaths. This started in the 90s when we decided that we needed to do something about the unauthorized migration across the border. We put technology, personnel, kind of harsher prosecutions in order to deter people from coming across the border. What it did was just move the migratory patterns. So people still crossed, but instead of crossing in these urban centers where there was care and help, they were crossing in desert areas. So we've tracked this for, we called it a funnel effect, and we've tracked this through time. And I was just looking at the data this week, and we're seeing migrations again. So people crossing in different areas. We've brought a lot of attention. The Rio Grande Valley has been kind of the hotbed of crossings for the last 7 years. and now that's moving. It's in the El Paso region. So this kind of moves based on policies and where we see infrastructure being put in place, people trying to evade that and going into other areas. So we're set. We haven't since 2006 seen the numbers that we're seeing this year. We should probably close out the year with twice as many people being apprehended on the border as last year. It's very concerning, the numbers. And one of the trends we saw several years ago is the increasing number of children that are crossing the border. And these are children that are coming that are unaccompanied. And I think the numbers, mostly I just want people to understand the scale of what we're talking about. We had 72,000 children that crossed the border last year that were apprehended. 72,000. Now, these are children that were traveling alone, so not with an adult or a family member. If we look at family units, we had 500,000 that crossed, and that's insane. So if we think about all these children that are crossing by themselves, we want to know where they're coming from. Most are coming from the Northern Triangle. The four largest contributors are Guatemala, Honduras, El Salvador, and Mexico. And when we're talking about children, it's in that order. There are fewer children coming from Mexico. And then when we look at single adult men, the majority are coming from Mexico. So trying to understand where are people coming from and why are they coming. And they're coming from the Northern Triangle, not just for economic reasons. And we can really see that when we see families and children. They're fleeing violence. And it's difficult to understand, as someone who has children, how you could allow your child. We don't let our child go 10 blocks away from the house by themselves. And sending your child from Guatemala to the U.S. by themselves is unimaginable. And what I really want people to know is that the choice that these parents are making to let their children do this is unimaginable. They're in such a horrible situation that there's no other possibility for these kids. I asked a mom. We had identified her son, who was 15, and she was from Guatemala. Why did she make the choice to let him come? And she said, well, if he stays, he was told if he didn't join the gang, they would kill him, and they'd kill his whole family. If he joined the gang, you don't live very long. It's a very violent culture, so he'd probably die. She said the only hope he had was to be somewhere else if I wanted him to live. And she was like, I had other children. We couldn't all go. I could only afford to get someone to take him alone. I can't imagine allowing my 15-year-old to travel like that. And I can't imagine having to make that choice. So we've really at Baylor been thinking, we've worked in this this identification process for a long while. We've helped to make a lot of changes and bring about changes with the U.S. government. We've impacted counties, and we've worked really great with some foreign nations and helping to bring some sort of resolution for families. But we're not really seeing any trends that tell us that one day we won't be needed in this work. And our goal now is to figure out what can we do to help stop the need of these children and these families from making this decision. What can we do, and how can we invest ourselves to change the problem and the source of the problem rather than the symptoms of the problem? And that's been refreshing to get to work with living individuals, but also very frustrating as well. It's difficult to find the right resources, and that's another scale issue. When you think about 70,000 children coming into the U.S. that are by themselves and they don't have family units to go to, how do we care for these children? And the scale of it is so big for people to understand. We're not talking about numbers that are actually manageable. We're talking about huge numbers. I mean, 70,000 is more than the population of the town I grew up in. Yeah. And this is happening every year. So we need some systemic change. We need people to come together and try to come up with solutions to one of the wickedest problems that we're facing right now in the U.S.
This is Baylor Connections. We are visiting with Dr. Lori Baker, Professor of Anthropology and Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity at Baylor. You talk about that being a wicked problem, a very complex problem. As a forensic anthropologist, but also someone who has great colleagues here at Baylor and at other schools, how do you even begin when you talk about working more on the front end, trying to impact the conditions that lead to people coming here, feeling the need to flee where they are? What does that even begin to look like?
You know, I thought it was overwhelming thinking about trying to identify folks that are typically trying to hide their identities and in a system that didn't exist. And then we started working on this end, and it's even more challenging. There are such good people with so much expertise at Baylor and in other places. One of the things that I love is that our students have a heart for caring for others. So we've been able to bring our students together and do things like design thinking sessions. We have a lab class, around Christian social innovation and thinking about child migration in the Western Hemisphere. So what can we do and how can we engage? And our students have come up with some really phenomenal ideas, and a lot of those are coming to fruition. Right now, what I think is going to be the most impactful thing that we're able to do as a university community, and I say as a family because I'm talking about our alumni, our students, our faculty, and our staff all coming together and to work with an organization, in particular Compassion International, and they care for the poorest children in the world. And through the work that they do, which is really, it's at the ground level, and it builds up, and they just provide support. But we've been looking at that organization because where they are in Latin America and the children that are involved in their programs are not being recruited into gangs. They're not having to flee the country because of violence. There's a lot of circumstances. They're not as malnourished as other kids in their area. They're getting more education than other kids in the area. And then they're not being recruited into gangs. So they're doing something right. And so Baylor's coming alongside Compassion and saying, okay, how can we increase your capacity so that we can make a difference at a country level? Is there a way that we can help to transform a nation so that it's not a contributing nation to this horrible migration event that's occurring? And it's been a really great partnership thinking through this. We're hoping to launch our official partnership in the spring. But our goal, there are 400,000 kids that live on less than $2 a day around the world. And how can we make an impact as a nation? But in particular, with Illuminate and our focus on Latin America and human flourishing, we think we can really make a difference to our neighbors. And frankly, we consider these countries our neighbors, and we ought to be investing there. And we're going to do so with an organization that knows how to help kids. So maybe, just maybe, we can make a dent in the 70,000 kids that are crossing the border by some of these efforts.
Well, that's very exciting. We'll look forward to that as we move into the spring and beyond as we visit with Dr. Lori Baker. And Lori, hearing you talk about the families and the decision they have to make, you've talked to families, obviously, in some very trying times. There has to be that deeper meaning, obviously, which you've really done such a great job over the last 20 minutes or so talking about. But what does that family aspect mean to you? I got to think those conversations are so tough, but also so vital.
You know, we try to give some information and context for these families. It's one thing to say, okay, we've identified your son and here he is, but they need to know more. As humans, the grieving process that we go through when we lose someone we love is very important, and that's truncated for these families. Sometimes they never get to go through the grieving process at all. And so having a chance to sit with them and tell them that people that they don't know love and care for them is really important. And I can't think of anything worse than having to tell a family this news. I can't until I tell a family that we don't have an identification. And so those families celebrate. They're so happy. Oh, it's not my loved one. This is wonderful news. And then a day or two later, they call me back and they're like, well, what now? We still don't know what happened to them. And we have families that call 25 years later that are looking for their loved one. My father went missing in 1990. My father went missing in the 1980s, somewhere around here. Do you think you can help me find him, or do you think you might have recovered him? And the chances of that are, you know, almost non-existent. So people don't move on. They don't forget about this. It's something that I could spend the rest of my life working on and not complete the challenge of being able to identify all these individuals and let their families know what happened. And that's why I'm very grateful to have these amazing and wonderful students who then go out and multiply what we're doing and carry it on themselves with the organizations that they work with.
Visiting with Lori Baker. And Lori, kind of final question here. For people, a lot of people, I think, sometimes want to help but don't know exactly how to. Are there ways that us lay people, if you will, can best help the situation?
You know, absolutely. I think being informed, talking to your legislators and saying, hey, you know, we want to see this change. We want to see something happen. How do we get involved, or how are you working on our behalf to do something about this? And then there are organizations that work in this space. And so if people can support those organizations, and I'll put in a plug for ours, if anyone wants to support. We are not funded by the federal government. We're funded by private donations, and that helps us to buy the things that we need, like gloves and gas to do the work that we do, and shovels. We're a pretty low-maintenance organization. But there are lots of ways to get involved, because there are, I mean, just thinking about the children that are crossing, they need places to go. And so there are communities within Texas that are welcoming these children. Waco right now is working on a program to train families to take these children in. So they'll be in foster families in our area through our local churches. I'm pretty impressed as a community that we've come together to get the resources we need to do this work and to welcome these kids in. So there are all sorts of opportunities, the border agencies that take them in. I'm very pleased to say Christians provide most of the support that's happening for these kids and families, and organizations that provide them with clothing and food and blankets. And so there are numerous ones. I could list them all out for you, but it's pretty easy to find them. And if you have resources that you can send, they're always appreciated, because there's never enough.
And you mentioned your organization, Reuniting Families, which people can find that online. Well, thanks so much for joining us today. I wish we had more time to dive even into this further, but you've done a great job helping us get a better handle on what's going on, and great work you and your students do. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Dr. Lori Baker, Professor of Anthropology and Vice Provost for Faculty Development and Diversity, our guest today on Baylor Connections. I'm Derek Smith. A reminder, you can hear this and other programs online, baylor.edu/connections. Thanks for joining us here on Baylor Connections.